Hello, and welcome to the Film Jerk Podcast. I'm your host, Edward Havens. On this first episode of a multi-part miniseries, we're going to take a look back at the curious case of the United Film Distribution Company and Taurus Entertainment, two movie distribution companies owned by the same company that were actually the same company. That was the fanfare for United Film Distribution Company there. The story of UFDC, which operated from 1973 to 1987, and Taurus, which operated from 1988 to 1989, actually begins decades earlier. You've heard of United Artists Pictures, right? The company behind 49 Best Picture nominees and 12 Best Picture winners, including Alfred Hitchcock's Rebecca, Billy Wilder's The Apartment, West Side Story, Midnight Cowboy, Rain Man, and in an incredible streak 3 years in a row in the mid-1970s, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, Rocky, and Annie Hall. The studio was famously started in February 1919 by director D.W. Griffith, actors Mary Pickford and Douglas Fairbanks, and actor-filmmaker Charlie Chaplin on the premise that allowing the talent to control their own interests rather than being dependent upon the commercial studios, that better films could be made while properly compensating the creators for their creations. Amongst the many avenues of interest created by United Artists in their early days were a chain of eponymously named movie theaters started in 1924, where their movies could play. Many of Hollywood studios owned their own theaters. Fox owned the Fox Theater chain, Paramount owned the United Paramount chain, RKO Pictures owned the RKO Theater chain, Warner Brothers owned the Warner chain, and so on. Their theaters would be lavishly designed, often seating more than 1,000 people, and were built in the biggest population centers in each major city. Each of these companies would often exclusively play their movies in their own theaters first run, shutting out a number of the smaller independent theaters outside of the major population centers until such time as the major studios felt that the films were played out and then released into the sticks. By the late 1930s, studio-owned theaters accounted for less than 20% of the theaters around the nation, but accounted for nearly half the ticket sales. The Federal Trade Commission had begun investigating film companies for possible violations of the Sherman Antitrust Act in 1890, but it wouldn't be until 1938 that the Department of Justice felt they had enough of a case to move forward. By then, it was fairly obvious the studios had created a series of oligopolies. They created the films. They had the producers and the directors and the writers and the actors under contract. They owned their own film processing laboratories. They printed their movies themselves. And they would get released into their own theaters. A perfect example of vertical integration. In all, 8 studios would be sued by the DOJ. Paramount, being the largest studio at the time, would be listed as the main defendant, but MGM, Warners, Fox, Universal, Columbia, RKO, and United Artists would also be included, as well as a number of the studio executives and their subdivisions. The United States versus Paramount Pictures would take nearly a decade to wind through the courts, with the District Court for the Southern District of New York deciding in favor of the studios barely 1 month after the end of World War II in 1945, before the Supreme Court reversed the Southern District's decision in May 1948. The Paramount Decree, as it is often referred to, required the studios to either give up their production abilities, their distribution abilities, or their exhibition abilities. In every instance, the studios would give up the theaters. United Artists would sell their theaters to brothers Robert and Marshall Nafee, who operated the California-based theater chain Golden State Theaters. Since the United Artists name was more familiar to moviegoers than Golden State, they kept the UA name for the acquired theaters and would rebrand their own Golden State Theaters as United Artists Theaters. The United Artists theater chain would continue to grow throughout the 50s and 60s, and in 1972, they would see an opportunity to get involved in acquiring and distributing completed projects. With the help of their executive, Sala M. Hassanian, United Artists Theaters would start the United Film Distribution Company. Obviously, they couldn't call themselves United Artists because that name in distribution was still being used by its original company. But the risks were few. Most of the movies they would acquire at the start would be lower-budgeted genre movies that, even if no other exhibitor bid on them, would be guaranteed to play in a few hundred theaters. And as long as UFDC did allow competitive bids from non-United Artists theaters, it could skirt any antitrust issues. The first movie UFDC would acquire and distribute was The Sinful Bed, a 1973 West German production about a bed who tells the stories of the various people who have used it for sexual purposes over the years. Yes, the bed is telling the story. The bed shares the tales of the first time it was used for a carnal adventure involving a sweet young virgin, a cunning prostitute who helps a wife get revenge on her unfaithful husband, a German soldier on leave for 2 hours during World War II, and a carefree modern couple. A softcore erotic nudie without all the stigma attached to a hardcore porn film, UFDC would spend time dubbing the film from German to English before releasing it into theaters in September 1974. Their second film would be Tintorera, Killer Shark, a 1978 British-Mexican co-production looking to jump in on the Jaws bandwagon. Shot on location in Cancun, this cheapy knockoff only had one thing going for it. The beautiful Susan George in bikinis and various midriff-bearing clothes. As two shark hunters vie for her attention when they are not after a large tiger shark who is terrorizing a small seaside tourist trap. That you probably have not heard of Tintorera, the way you have Orca or The Deep, should be a hint at how popular it was with moviegoers. But their third film would bring the company their first success.
Award-winning motion picture producer Samuel L. Bronkowitz.
I have spent a lifetime in the motion picture industry. Now, after 50 years in Hollywood, I have finally produced what I feel is the finest motion picture ever made. I have called it the Kentucky Fried Movie. The Kentucky Fried Movie heralds the return to traditional values.
I'm not wearing any pants. Film at 11.
It is a film of heartfelt passion, a great love story.
Oh, take me to the drive and prove yourself.
It explores the subtle nuances of interpersonal relationships. Of course, there are occasional moments of comic relief. The Kentucky Fried Movie is a film that demands the greatest performances from the finest actors of the cinema.
Hey, look, Wally. Wally.
I tell you, this building is unsafe.
City's in flames. The National Guard is powerless to deal with the situation. Governor, what are we going to do?
An anticipated 10% price hike across the board on petroleum products.
I invite every man, woman, and child to share with me the joy and warmth of the Kentucky Fried Movie. It will knock your socks off.
The Kentucky Fried Movie was one of a number of sketch comedy movies that were popular in the mid-1970s after Tunnel Vision, and if you don't stop it, you'll go blind. The movie was born from the Kentucky Fried Theater comedy troupe created by David Zucker, Jim Abrams, and Jerry Zucker when they were still living in Madison, Wisconsin before moving to Los Angeles. Zucker, Abrams, and Zucker wrote the screenplay in 1975 in the hopes of using the movie as a calling card into the film industry. Along with aspiring filmmaker John Landis, the trio raised $35,000 in order to shoot one of the sketches, which they showed to Salah Hassanian, who agreed to co-finance the remaining production and distribute the final film, provided they find additional investors. Kim Jorgensen, the president of the Parallax Theater chain, joined the team as an executive producer after seeing the short and helped to recruit additional investors. The $1 million film would shoot for 28 days in and around Pasadena during the early winter of 1977 and would include the participation of musician Stephen Bishop and actors Bill Bixby, Tony Dow, Henry Gibson, and Donald Sutherland, who so enjoyed working with Landis that he would take a small role in Landis's next movie, National Lampoon's Animal House. The movie featured 22 segments parodying television shows, commercials, and movie trailers, along with a 31-minute kung fu movie not unlike Bruce Lee's Enter the Dragon. The movie would become a minor sensation in theaters, grossing more than $7 million after opening in 22 theaters in Los Angeles and New York City, 18 of those belonging to United Artists Theaters, on Wednesday, August 10, 1977. Zucker, Abrams, and Zucker would become famous with their next movie, Airplane. UFDC's next film would become their biggest hit to date.
In 1968, George Romero brought us Night of the Living Dead. It became the classic horror film of its time. Now, George Romero brings us the most intensely shocking motion picture experience for all times. Dawn of the Dead. Night of the Living Dead has ended. Dawn of the Dead is here.
Get in the room! Get out of here!
It gets up and kills. The people it kills get up and kill.
They must be destroyed on sight.
When there is no more room in hell, the dead will walk the earth. Dawn of the Dead.
UFDC had nothing to do with the production of George A. Romero's Dawn of the Dead, but would become an important part of its success. After a decade of films that failed to match the cultural impact of his debut feature, Night of the Living Dead, Romero would return to the zombie genre that would make him a filmmaking icon. Working with Italian filmmaker Dario Argento, a fan of Night of the Living Dead and the first investor in Dawn of the Dead, Romero would change the direction of zombie and horror movies forever, with his pointed commentary on American consumerism and materialism. After premiering in Italy in September 1978, UFDC would pick the film up for an American distribution. The film would be submitted to the Motion Picture Association of America for a rating, where it would naturally receive an X rating for its graphic violence. UFDC and Romero decided to have the movie released without a rating. A number of exhibitors in the 1970s would not release any movie that did not have an MPAA rating. But having a distributor, who also operated a large number of theaters, ensured hundreds of playdates, even if no other exhibitor touched it. It would make its American debut at the USA Film Festival in Dallas on April 7, 1979, personally selected for the festival by Roger Ebert, before opening in 17 theaters in Romero's hometown of Pittsburgh on April 13th. The film would be rolled out to theaters in an unusual pattern. After Pittsburgh, the film would open in 59 theaters in New York City and another 27 theaters in Cincinnati and Portland, Oregon on April 20th, and then another 103 theaters in Atlanta, Charlotte, Jacksonville, and Washington, D.C. on April 27th. It would add another 98 theaters in Albany, Buffalo, Dallas, Indianapolis, and San Francisco on May 4th, before arriving in 51 theaters in Los Angeles and 13 theaters in Milwaukee on May 11th. The film would play all summer, and not just in United Artists theaters. Whatever trepidation other exhibitors may have had about playing an unrated horror film were vanquished when they saw the early box office grosses. Dawn of the Dead grossed nearly $1 million in just those 17 theaters in Pittsburgh its first week, and more than $5 million after its first month, before it even opened in Los Angeles. The final box office totals would be $16 million in the United States and Canada, and another $50 million in the remainder of the world. Romero finally had another hit on his hands. United Film Distribution's first movie of the 1980s was Sitting Ducks, a comedy from filmmaker Henry Jaglom. I wouldn't be too surprised if you're not familiar with the name Henry Jaglom or his works. Jaglom was an unsuccessful actor who segued into a mildly successful career as a television director of such pabulum as The Flying Nun and Gidget. He would get a chance to direct his first feature, 1971's A Safe Place, after befriending Jack Nicholson while Jaglom was working as an assistant editor on Easy Rider, and befriending Orson Welles when Jaglom was hired to play himself during a party scene in Welles' long uncompleted The Other Side of the Wind. Nicholson would help get A Safe Place produced through BBS Productions, who had produced Easy Rider, and was also responsible for the creation of the Monkees television show and the 1968 Monkees movie Head. And both Nicholson and Welles would co-star in A Safe Place to lend some star power. But despite having the support of one of the biggest production companies in Hollywood at the time, and two of the biggest names in cinema, and a studio, Columbia, distributing the movie, A Safe Place would not find success with moviegoers or with critics. If you really want to see it, it's available as part of the Criterion Collection's BBS Productions box set called America Lost and Found, which also includes Head, Easy Rider, Five Easy Pieces, Drive He Said, The Last Picture Show, and The King of Marvin Gardens. It's easily the worst movie in that set. It would take Jaglom 5 years to raise the $1 million needed to make his next movie. And although Dennis Hopper, by 1976, was considered a washed-up has-been, Jaglom would recruit his friend to star in Tracks, one of the first movies to explore the psychological cost of the Vietnam War on returning soldiers. Hopper would play a soldier who accompanies one of his platoon mate's body via train for a hometown funeral. Along his journey, he meets up with a variety of people who are unsure of how to deal with a veteran with some serious issues. Tracks is not a great movie, but it's far better than A Safe Place. But moviegoers weren't quite ready to deal with Vietnam as part of their film entertainment so soon after the end of the conflict. It would be another 2 years before audiences accepted movies like Apocalypse Now, Coming Home, and The Deer Hunter, and Tracks would virtually disappear for another 2 decades. When Sitting Ducks came around in 1980, there wasn't much initial buzz surrounding it. The $750,000 film was produced and financed independently with the help of its star, Zach Norman, who, when he wasn't acting, was helping to finance movies such as Tracks and the 1971 cult vampire lesbian movie Daughters of the Darkness, under his real name, Howard Zucker. Norman and Jaglom would meet thanks to their mutual friend, Bert Schneider, one of the B's in the BBS production company that produced A Safe Place, for whom Norman, as Zucker, would finance Schneider's 1975 Oscar-winning documentary about the Vietnam War, Hearts and Minds. Norman and Jaglom's actor brother, Michael Emil, star as two small-time criminals who both fall in love with a not very successful singer-songwriter, played by Jaglom's then-wife, Patrice Townsend, while they are on the run from the mob after they steal a considerable amount of money. In order to save money on the production, Jaglom would resort to using real people who just happened to be in a location they were shooting at for a scene. During part of a stay at a Holiday Inn, Jaglom and his team would grab scenes at the restaurant at the motel, using the waitress who was serving them as the waitress who was serving them. The production would run into a bar, get quick permission from the owner or manager to shoot there for a few moments, and just have the barflies hanging out playing barflies who were just hanging out at a bar. If they didn't have a permit to shoot in a certain location, Jaglom would hide the cinematographer and the camera under a blanket while sitting in a wheelchair, and then whip the blanket off to get the shot they needed before loading everything into a production van before the police could arrive to shut them down. Townsend would style her own hair and rarely wear makeup during production, and the filmmakers would regularly shoot scenes in whatever light was available, and having the actors wear whatever clothes they had without concern whether they had the right props for any given scene. This all sounds like chaos, but it works within the confines of this movie. UFDC was planning to open the film during the late summer of 1980, but when the movie was surprisingly selected as an official entry into the 1980 Cannes Film Festival, UFDC would rush the film into theaters, creating a new ad campaign to signify the importance of that selection, opening the movie at one of their New York City flagship theaters, the Gemini Twin, on the Upper East Side on April 4th. Critics loved the movie. Several of them, including Judith Crist of the New York Times, David Denby of New York Magazine, Bruce Williamson of Playboy, and Fred Yeager of the Associated Press, would hail the comedy team of Norman and Emile, comparing them to the likes of the Marx Brothers, or Jack Lemmon and Walter Matthau. The critics would also compare Jaglom's work to the likes of Woody Allen, Frank Capra, Jean-Luc Godard, and François Truffaut. And audiences would make Sitting Ducks a big enough hit where Jaglom and Norman, as Zucker, would be able to spend most of the next two decades finding more funding for Jaglom's future movies, which Jaglom would start releasing through his own distribution company, Rainbow Releasing. With the success of Dawn of the Dead, Halloween, and Friday the 13th, horror films were all the rage, and UFDC would find themselves being approached by Lloyd Kaufman and Michael Herz of Troma Films to distribute a movie they had produced called Mother's Day. Directed by Lloyd's brother Charles, and co-written by Charles Kaufman and future Law & Order Criminal Intent and SVU showrunner Warren Leight, the movie was a rather gruesome adventure about three young women on a camping excursion who fall victim to two deranged, murderous young men and their unhinged mother. The levels of violence in the movie were shocking even for the early 80s horror genre, and the film would, like Dawn of the Dead, need to be released without an MPAA rating. Those who did venture to see Mother's Day would find it very unsettling, especially scenes which featured the graphic, violent rapes of the women. The film would open on 90 screens in the New York City metropolitan area on September 19, 1980, and would wind its way throughout other markets for the next 7 weeks until it made its final stop in Los Angeles on November 14th. But by this time, the horror market was flooded. Mother's Day was competing for ticket buyers alongside Alligator, often paired with Eaten Alive, The Boogeyman, often paired with The Toolbox Murders, Diabolical, Fade to Black, Motel Hell, and Terror Train, as well as Friday and Saturday night midnight shows of Dawn of the Dead. By the time it reached Los Angeles, it would only play on 12 screens, never on its own, and often as the B title of a double feature. The $150,000 film would gross less than $2 million during its short theatrical run. UFDC's first release of 1981 would be George A. Romero's Night Riders. After years of trying to get financing to make a movie out of the 1958 novel The Once and Future King about the life of King Arthur, Romero instead decided to craft a new story about a medieval reenactment troupe who uses motorcycles instead of horses for their jousts, and how their leader Billy starts to lose his grip on reality as he has trouble keeping the troupe together. Romero and his producing partner, Richard P. Rubenstein, would approach UFDC about financing the $3 million movie. Instead, they would end up signing a three-picture deal with the company, of which Knight Riders would be the first. UFDC would provide half the budget in exchange for North American distribution rights, while, ironically, United Artists Pictures would put up the other half for foreign distribution rights. UFDC wanted to be in the George Romero business, and Romero was happy to be wanted and funded. Like most Romero movies, Knight Riders would be shot in and around his hometown of Pittsburgh. The great Ed Harris would get his first starring role as Billy, while Romero friend and makeup effects genius Tom Savini would get his biggest acting role to date as Billy's main rival, Morgan. Stephen King, who came to Pittsburgh to talk to Romero about a movie idea they were collaborating on, would end up making his acting debut in the film, playing Hoagie Man. And Mrs. King, Tabitha, would also get roped into the production, playing the Hoagie Man's wife. Production on the film would run from early May to early August 1980, although a strike by the Screen Actors Guild threatened to shut down production 4 weeks before the end of shooting. But a clerical error by the Guild, not informing the production of the possibility of a strike at least 60 days before the start of a strike, meant the production could continue, even though the Screen Actors Guild did indeed go on strike. Good news to the more than 1,000 local extras and dozens of local production workers who rarely saw work in their area outside of Romero Productions. Another person who would unexpectedly benefit from the production was actress Christine Forrest, who played Morgan's girlfriend. She would fall in love with her director during production, and she and Romero would marry days after the end of principal photography. Originally titled Nights, Romero and UFDC were forced to change the title during production when filmmaker John Borman filed a complaint with the MPAA, as he had already registered the title Nights for his own adaptation of the Arthurian legend. And the two films would keep bumping into each other. In late December 1980, after UFDC had already sent out posters and trailers to theaters introducing the now-titled Knight Riders to theaters, Borman changed the title of his movie to Excalibur. And then after UFDC announced in early February 1981 that they would be releasing Knight Riders on April 10th, Orion and Warner Brothers announced the release of Excalibur for April 10th. Excalibur was given a lavish multi-million dollar advertising campaign, including primetime commercials and multi-page ads in major city newspapers. It would open in first place nationwide with more than $4.5 million in ticket sales from 692 theaters. Knight Riders would not have any primetime commercials, and quarter-page ads at best, when it opened on 24 screens in Los Angeles and another two dozen screens in several Florida cities. It could barely manage $100,000 in ticket sales. The following week, Knight Riders would open in 38 theaters in the New York City metropolitan area, and another 10 in and around Romero's hometown of Pittsburgh. Maybe it's because New York doesn't really pay attention to Los Angeles or the trades, but Vincent Canby of the New York Times would start his review of Knight Riders, wondering if it was merely coincidence that this movie was opening 1 week after Excalibur, before wondering if Romero knew what Borman had been up to. But that would set the tone for the rest of Knight Rider's theatrical release, being treated like a rushed, cheapy knockoff of a bigger movie. The film would not gross enough to even cover its modest production budget, but that wouldn't deter the distributor from working with Romero again in the future, as we will soon see. If you can recognize the name Mustafa Akkad unaided, it's most likely because you've seen his name on a lot of the Halloween movies. Some of you might remember him as the director of the controversial 1976 movie Mohammed, Messenger of God, known as The Message in the United States, which received some exceptional critical reviews when it was being released, but there would be an unfortunate situation where an extremist religious group who believed the film depicted the prophet on screen against their beliefs, stormed a B'nai B'rith temple in Washington, D.C., and threatened to blow up the building and kill all of the hostages if the movie was released. A D.C. police officer and a local journalist covering the siege would be killed before the standoff was over, and the movie's box office prospects would never recover. In the late 1970s, with the assistance of Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi, Akkad would return to filmmaking with Lion of the Desert, a $35 million epic about the 1929 Italian-Senussi War, featuring Anthony Quinn as the Bedouin tribal leader Omar Mukhtar, who led an army to oust the fascist Italians who had taken control of Libya. The cast would also include Irene Papas, Raf Vallone, Rod Steiger as Benito Mussolini, and Sir John Gielgud as Sharif El-Gharyani. Modern critics have been kinder to the film than upon its original release, although Vincent Canby would call it spectacular. The film would open in Madrid just before Christmas 1980, before opening in American theaters on April 17, 1981. But despite its cast, the 173-minute running time and tepid reviews would keep audiences away, where the film would finish a six-week theatrical run with only $1.5 million in ticket sales. On May 12th, UFDC would release Death Screams, a cheapy horror film starring former Playboy playmate Susan Carger, in which a group of teenagers are stalked and murdered by a crazed maniac during a town fair. The only thing remotely interesting about this movie is that it was directed by David Nelson, of The Adventures of Ozzie and Harriet fame. It would play the drive-in circuit for a few weeks, but quickly fade away, without ever playing in major cities like Los Angeles, New York, or Chicago. Their next film would be a bit more popular and a bit more controversial.
Class of 1984. Class of 1984. Their only goal is power.
I run this school, man.
Their only law is survival.
If you want to survive around here, you have got to learn to look the other way.
Their only allegiance is to themselves.
Still believe in all that bullshit that holds it together?
I pledge allegiance!
Wise, you'd have done me right. Like this!
He tried to kill me!
Somebody's got to stop this insanity.
Well, you simply can't afford to fail this class. Now, what is the answer?
I am the future. I am the future. I am the future.
But you've taught before and nothing like this has ever happened.
All right, I got to deal with it. Who's going to protect you?
He's one man trained to deal with students, but they've pushed him to the limit. They've gone too far. Now he's going to give the class of 1984 the lesson they deserve. Class of 1984, is this the future?
Take a look at my face.
Mark L. Lester is what film aficionados affectionately call a journeyman director. He didn't really have a style that made his films uniquely his, and of the 26 movies he directed between 1973 and 2014, including Firestarter, Commando, and Showdown in Little Tokyo, he only had a hand in writing four of them. Class of 1984 would be one of the four he helped to write. Perry King would star as a music teacher who must deal with an unruly gang of punks at a troubled inner-city school. Planet of the Apes co-star Roddy McDowall would be featured as a gun-packing fellow teacher, and Michael J. Fox would have one of his earliest roles as Arthur, who plays the trumpet in King's class. Lester was inspired to write the movie after reading several stories about the plight of teachers in schools, especially one story about a teacher who was so worried for his own safety, he would bring a gun into his own classroom. Lester would cite A Clockwork Orange as a major influence on the class of 1984, and in many ways the newer film is a spiritual successor of the older film. And like A Clockwork Orange, Class of 1984 would run afoul of the British film censors, who would force Lester to cut more than 4.5 minutes from the final film in order for it to get certified for theatrical release there. In America, the producers had trouble selling the film to distributors. Only going to UFDC after being rejected by all the major studios and many of the independents. Featuring a memorable song by Alice Cooper, I Am the Future, written specifically for the movie based on a reoccurring theme within the movie, the $4.5 million production would open on 77 screens in New York City on August 20th and work its way around the country until finishing its run by opening in 62 theaters in Los Angeles on October 8th. And while the idea of punk rockers running rampant through the hallways of American high schools scared the crap out of parental units all across the country, none of them actually saw the movie, which grossed a respectable but not particularly memorable $6.97 million. Horror was regularly a big sell in the early 1980s, and one of the best names in horror at the time was filmmaker Larry Cohen, thanks to his mid-1970s classic, It's Alive, and the next film we're going to talk about, Q, The Winged Serpent.
For 10 centuries it has waited to be awakened, to be worshipped again like a god, to fill the skies, to cast its shadow over the earth, to release its fury. Today in New York City, the winged serpent rises. The winged serpent rules. The winged serpent. David Carradine.
This thing has been prayed back into existence.
Michael Moriarty.
It was big and there was something in it that looked like an egg. But it couldn't have been an egg. I mean, there aren't any eggs. There's no egg that big.
Richard Roundtree.
What I want to know is, how the hell does this tie in with the murders and the mutilations?
Candy Clark.
What are you going to do if someone dies tomorrow, or the next day, or the next day?
Well, I'm not going to think about it. You know, it won't be my fault. It'll be theirs if they don't give me what I want.
Money. $1 million in cash, tax-free.
They are searching.
Looking good.
Discovering. Believing. And preparing for the battle of 1,000 years.
Load tracer ammunition. Want to see the trajectory?
Get those guys out of the basket!
Okay, everybody hold their positions. Everybody stay right where you are, all right? Don't move!
Against the fantastic flying forces of a lost age.
You like saying a prayer?
A man against the winged serpent. Today in New York City, the winged serpent rules. The legend has come alive.
Cohen, a native of New York City, was walking around the city one day in the late 1970s, and he just happened to glance up at the Chrysler Building and think to himself, that would be the coolest place to find an egg. And that's how the idea of the movie was born, a random thought while randomly looking up at one of the city's many iconic buildings. He quickly wrote a screenplay, using the legendary Aztec god Quetzalcoatl as a winged serpent that's terrorizing the city. The police are mystified by reports of attacks throughout the city, and only one man, an ex-con, knows where the beast is hiding, and he wants $1 million from the city to give up the location. In late 1981, Larry Cohen was directing I, the Jury, an adaptation of the Mickey Spillane story featuring Armand DeSante as Mike Hammer, when he was fired from the production after learning the producers were running out of money, and he was informing certain members of the cast and crew to make sure they were getting paid in advance. But instead of just quietly slinking into the night, Cohen pulled out the screenplay for Q that he had been working on, and would start shooting scenes in the city 2 days later while he worked on getting the film financed and cast. Cohen would call up David Carradine, with whom he'd served in the army many years earlier, and Carradine would be there for his friend. Michael Moriarty, a respected but not very well-known New York actor at the time, would join the production without hesitation after overhearing Cohen tell a friend how good an actor Moriarty was when they were separately having lunch at the same cafe on the Upper West Side, and would, in the years to come, be a regular staple in Cohen's movies. Cohen would also get Candy Clark from American Graffiti, Shaft himself Richard Roundtree, and even Los Angeles Dodgers third baseman Ron Say to play a small role during the off-season. Cohen would finally be able to get $1.2 million together to make the film, a good portion of which would be spent on creating the stop-motion animation needed to bring Q to life. While in the years after its release it would become a beloved cult classic, audiences did not warm up to Q when it arrived in theaters on October 29th. UFDC would only report a gross of about $255,000 after 3 weeks of release. Earlier in the episode, I mentioned George Romero's three-picture deal with UFDC. One of the aspects of the deal was that it was non-exclusive, meaning Romero was not required to develop material specifically for the company, but he would be required to come to them first with any new material he wanted to make. And we mentioned earlier, Stephen King came to visit Romero during the production of Knight Riders to talk about a film that they were planning to make together. Now, if you've been paying attention to the timeline, we are now entering the fall of 1982, so I'm sure you already know what film I'm talking about here. The Stand. Yes, when King and Romero met up, they were planning on adapting King's magnum opus into a major motion picture. King's first draft of the screenplay had run hundreds of pages and would have resulted in a movie, as long as both Godfather movies put together. King's second draft would turn it into a pair of two-hour movies, with a combined budget expected to run over $25 million. But despite the promise of two movies from two kings of horror, UFDC wasn't quite ready to go for something that big and that expensive. So they would ask if there was maybe something else that the pair had an idea for that could be made for less. And yes, they already had. In 1979, while initially meeting about making The Stand, the two men started throwing ideas around, wanting to come up with a movie that would scare people continuously throughout the movie. They would eventually settle on a horror anthology, several short stories of terror. While they were still coming up with the stories, they started flirting with the idea of how to make them. Maybe one of them would be in black and white. Maybe one of them in 3D. This being 2 years before the start of the 1980s 3D craze with Coming At Ya in 1981. But eventually, they decided all of this would be too radical an idea, and they would latch onto a main idea. Five stories wrapped together like a cheap comic book, not unlike the EC comics both men had become enthralled with as younger men. And King would come up with the title. Creepshow.
Coming soon. Jolting tales of horror. Creepshow. From the author of Carrie, The Shining, and Cujo. And the creator of Night of the Living Dead and Dawn of the Dead. You'll scream at ghastly ghouls. Cringe at weird kids and shiver at the doings of evil doctors.
This is going to be extremely painful, Mr. Verrill.
Creepshow will grab you, grow on you, and give you the creeps.
Yeah. Shaw, this is going to be an entirely new experience.
Creepshow, the most fun you'll ever have being scared.
Two months after the two men had started discussing the idea while drinking beer in his main living room, Stephen King had a completed screenplay. While three of the stories, Father's Day, Something to Tide You Over, and They're Creeping Up on You, were original ideas, two of the stories would be adapted from previously published King stories. The Crate had been originally published in the July 1979 issue of the adult sex magazine Gallery, while The Lonesome Death of Geordie Verrill, in which King would star, was originally published as Weeds in the May 1976 issue of the adult sex magazine Cavalier. And when UFDC was looking for a follow-up to Knight Riders, they would relish the idea of this new idea that had been sitting around for nearly 2 years. Creepshow, of course, would become Romero's biggest production to date. It would be the first time he would be able to work on actual sound stages instead of just shooting wherever he could. It would be the first time he would get to work with name actors like Adrian Barbeau, Hal Holbrook, E.G. Marshall, and Leslie Nielsen. It would be his biggest budgeted film to date at $8 million. And it would be the first time UFDC would consider selling one of their movies to a competing distributor. After Romero had spent most of the fall of 1981 shooting the movie in various locations around Pittsburgh, including his alma mater of Carnegie Mellon University, and the winter and spring editing it into a 129-minute film, UFDC would take the completed film to the market at that year's Cannes Festival, where they would end up making most of their initial investment back in sales to a number of international territories. But unexpectedly, a critic from Variety attended one of the market screenings and filed a glowing review that ended with, "The film is top of its class and should generate substantial box office business. A surefire picture for the summer movie crowd." Now, some websites will tell you that the Variety review and the Cannes Festival frenzy led Warner Brothers to make a play for the film. But in truth, UFDC showed the movie to all the major studios in late April, looking for a distribution partner. And Warners would outbid Paramount and Universal to not team up with UFDC, but to completely purchase the domestic distribution rights. UFDC would profit from the film before a single theater had ever shown it. But they would have to ask theaters they had already sent posters and trailers to remove and destroy those items and await new marketing materials from Warners. Shortly after those Cannes market screenings, Romero would host an invitation-only screening of the movie for the cast and crew in New York City. The screening went fantastic, as did several test screenings that were held in various locations around the country. But despite all the accolades, Romero was not 100, as the kids say today, with the movie. He would spend most of July in Los Angeles, trimming 9 minutes from the film and finishing the sound mix. Now, some websites will tell you that Creepshow played a successful 4-week trial run at several theaters in the Boston area in July 1982. This is not true. The fall 1982 issue of the late great magazine Cine Fantastique, which devoted more than 20 pages to the making of the film, notes the July time Romero spent in Los Angeles mixing the movie. And there are zero reviews or ads in any of the local Boston newspapers for any show of Creepshow in July 1982. What actually happened is that there was a trial run of the film at the Garden City Cinema in Providence, Rhode Island, starting on August 20th, 1982, which lasted for 3 weeks, which was successful enough for Warners to move the movie out of the Halloween release season, which already had a Halloween movie set for release, and instead prepare it for a mid-November launch. When Warners released Creepshow into 1,127 screens nationwide on Wednesday, November 10th, Universal's third Halloween movie, Season of the Witch, had already come and gone, and audiences were primed for something new and different. The film would open in first place with $5.87 million, beating the previous number one film, First Blood, by more than $2 million. But like all horror movies, the opening week audience was front-loaded, and by week two, it would slip to third place. First Blood would remain in second place, beating Creepshow by little more than $200,000. But the number one film that week would be the first re-release of The Empire Strikes Back. But while UFDC may have sold the distribution rights to Creepshow, they would still maintain ownership of the property. Even today, with the Creepshow series that runs on Shudder, the company that UFDC would become in a few years from where we are now in this story still maintains control of the property. And we will get to that part of the story on our next episode. Thank you for joining us. We'll talk again soon. The Film Jerk podcast has been researched, written, narrated, and edited by Edward Havens for Idiosyncratic Entertainment. Thank you again. Good night.